Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. Cannock Chase, located in Staffordshire, England, is designated as an area of outstanding natural beauty. An enchanted wood, if you will. A 90 square mile nature reserve that is not only the stuff of fairy tale, but nightmare as well. The black-eyed girls are said to haunt this land locally known as The Chase. Black-eyed children have been reported worldwide and are thought to be demonic entities guising themselves as children in order to manipulate the living into danger. There is a high probability that this is a bunch of horse shit. These black-eyed girls running around the woods with their white slips. To be clear, a black-eyed girl, like this hollowed-out eyes, there's no eyeballs there, it's just this deep blackness. But when it comes to the black-eyed girls of the Chase, of Cannock Chase, there's a history here that's most unsettling, once paired with reports of little girls in white calling hikers deeper into the wood. Little girls whom on occasion show their faces, often after being hidden by delicate, ghostly hands, to reveal those empty eye sockets filled with a deep blackness, most unsettling, an ancient blackness that maybe drove the so-called monster of the Chase to finish his victims here. Welcome to Dark Topic. I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. Monster of the Chase. While it is haunting to imagine the ghostly, giggling, black-eyed girls of Cannock Chase peeking from trees, teasing those out for a stroll, standing ahead on the pathways and running away in hopes of provoking a chase through the chase, it's even more unsettling to know for certain that at one time, bright-eyed, teary-eyed, sobbing little girls were once brought along these same trails to die out here. The Chase Monster, as far as we know, began his reign of terror on December the 2nd of 1964. This is when, at around midnight, a cyclist pedaling through the rain on the outskirts of an English mining town begins hearing the cries of what he thinks might be a wounded animal. It is dark, cold, wet, and miserable. Not an ideal night for a bike ride, and not the most picturesque setting either. The man on the bike is traveling past slag heaps, small mountains of waste material from the mining process. In the rain and in the darkness, this section appears in the occasional flash of lightning as a hellhole, and the whimpers that the cyclist now rolls to a stop to better hear are either a minion of Satan luring him to danger, or the soft cries of a child, he now realizes. Because he's brave enough to be out here in the first place, the man sets down his bike and steps carefully into the dark treachery off-road around midnight, and soon finds a half-naked little girl weakly sobbing in a ditch. He picks the girl up. She is bleeding down her bare legs. She is half-conscious and shivering from the cold and rain. The elements are only 20 minutes or so from finishing the job for the monster who tossed her here like trash. The cyclist flags down a passing van, and soon the little girl is at a hospital, being nursed back to health. 9-year-old Julia Taylor, who had gone missing from miles away a little earlier the same evening. As Julia recovers, she has trouble recalling the assault itself. She does know that as she was making her way home under street lamps at around 9 p.m., a man in a big car, two-toned with fins on the back and a spotlight on the driver's side, like police cars have, this man pulled to a stop beside her and introduced himself as her Uncle Len. The man had a full head of dark hair and a handsome, clean-shaven face, featuring big brown eyes that maybe charmed the girl. Uncle Len claimed that Julia's mother had sent him. He was to take Julia to her aunt's house and pick up some Christmas presents. Julia doesn't know if she has an Uncle Len or an Aunt Len, but she's quite excited at the mention of gifts, and she recalls fully believing this to be her Uncle Len's car, and how cool it is entering through the heavy passenger side door, and how cool it is to have an Uncle Len. And she recalls climbing into the warmth of the car and just feeling great excitement. But those flames of excitement are soon doused with dread as she's driven out of town, as no matter how young and naive, a child knows when they've gotten themselves into big trouble. Uncle Len's demeanor morphs from warm and friendly to cold, then lurid, as they drive. A full-grown man has stolen a 9-year-old girl, so small in the front seat of the big family car, newspapers underneath her, doo-wop lightly playing on the radio as he reaches over, the hooded eye of a half-moon above, glinting through the windshield and reflecting off his silver wristwatch. It's late. She's long due home. Uncle Len, can we go back soon? But he's through with this act. They drive on as he fumbles with her, all the way to the slag heaps where she's viciously raped, this terrified child. Her internals damaged significantly as a result. Then she is strangled and tossed unconscious into the misery of a dark ditch that's slowly filling with rain. Christmas lights everywhere as the monster makes his way back home. Satiated, though not entirely certain that he squeezed the little one's throat sufficiently. The holidays are stressful enough, aren't they, Uncle Len, without worrying about such things. He'll take the next one to the woods. And be sure. September 8th, 1965. It's another rainy day, this time in Aston, when 6-year-old Margaret Reynolds, dressed smartly in her big button slicker, a flowery skirt flowing beneath, is abducted while returning to her primary school, following lunch. Her parents don't become aware of her disappearance until school lets out, and Margaret fails to return home. Her older sister had split ways with her after lunch and went back to pick her up after school, didn't find her. Her parents, hours later, became quite worried, and a massive search and investigation it follows. Local residents are shocked to learn that a white man in a nice car had been attempting to lure girls into his vehicle during the summer leading to this back-to-school abduction. They didn't know. There's 5, 6, 7 girls who've been molested already and hadn't said a word until now. And they come forward to their parents once this abduction happens to share they've been invited to a car with a man whom had, quote, digitally penetrated them. And that's not a quote from the girls, clearly. That's just the way it was put across by investigators once they learned what had happened to them. Sometimes when these things are explained as correctly as someone thinks that they can be, they come off even worse, don't they? Digitally penetrated. Christ. I mean, what would be better? I'm not going to say it, but yeah, maybe digitally penetrated is better. Despite a massive effort, with 25,000 interviews and hundreds of missing posters featuring the pretty little girl with the big button slicker, 6-year-old Margaret Reynolds remains missing through the Christmas of 65, and her abductor remains hungry for more. December the 30th, 5-year-old Diana Joy Tift is abducted at around 2 p.m. outside her grandmother's house on Chapel Street in Walsall. She, like Margaret Reynolds, was wearing a hooded slicker. The abductor is taking advantage of the weather, it seems, offering little ones shelter from the street in his vehicle. There is another massive search effort, but it will take a stroke of luck to find the kindergartner. 2 weeks later, on January the 12th of 66, a man hunting rabbits off a desolate farm road in Cannock Chase, the wood I talked about in the beginning, he peers into some bramble and finds the body of a little girl in a muddy ditch. This is Diana Tift. The 5-year-old has been raped and suffocated by the hood of her coat, which lays over her face. The investigators swarm the area, reaching it from the A34 road, a road which the killer most certainly used to get Diana, to this section of the chase. There is much talk of this likely being the road used to steal away 6-year-old Margaret Reynolds as well, since it runs by her last known location. This is not a highway, they describe it as a road, but it runs between these counties. And it's the way in which he's using this road to jump into small villages and then bring them back on this road. And it leads to Cannock Chase, this large, you know, woods that we've been talking about. Just so you can kind of get it into your mind. It's kind of like a vein running through. Sorry, it's a road. Okay, let's not try to be too fucking fancy about it. It's a road that runs through, and then there's points to get off to go out to all these villages. I live in a place kind of like this where there's a road, and then you can just jump off into little villages. We all know what I'm talking about. I'm overdoing it. But then that road eventually will go past Cannock Chase, which is a large wood where you can hide within and kill within. And it's a fabled wood, a haunted wood. If you look up Cannock Chase, you'll find, and I won't get it too much into that on this episode. I'll stick to true horror. The moniker of the A34 killer is thrown around by the press as they converge on Cannock Chase. It makes sense he'd use this road in this place, the chase. The whole thing is custom made for child killing. Will he find others in the woods? Has the killer been stealing little ones forever from the pockets of people along the A34 and bringing them here to finish in peace? Will they find Margaret Reynolds out here as well? As word gets out that Diana Tift has been discovered raped and strangled in a marshy area of Cannock Chase, volunteers begin organizing to search the fabled wood for Margaret. That is until later that day when a crime scene photograph is being studied and Margaret appears within it. These are 5 and 6-year-old kids, remember. She, Margaret, and the photo is under Diana. This is initially overlooked because she has been here much longer, and her decomposed body is naked save a shoe, but there she is, fused in the mud beneath the obvious little body of Diana Tift. Margaret Reynolds is there, and she is finally found. 2 little girls abducted, raped, strangled, and dumped together. The press calls him the A34 killer, but soon he'll be better known as the monster of Cannock Chase. This particularly horrific crime scene will become known as the Babes in the Ditch murders. It is an absolutely terrifying thing. Scotland Yard is put on the case, and around-the-clock investigation begins. Communities along the A34 and around Cannock Chase keep a close watch on their little ones. A stop plan is put in place for police forces. Any report of a missing child will initiate a complete lockdown of the A34 and a swarm of the chase. And I need to stop here because I think I missed something. I don't know if I've really made you feel the horror of what went down there. So the body of Diana Tift is discovered, and they find the body of Margaret Reynolds later through a photo underneath her. But what I really need to explain is that her body is so decomposed and so embedded into the mud beneath Diana that initially they didn't even know there was another little body underneath. Until they studied a photo, and I believe they saw a shoe. They saw 3 shoes. They're like, why is there 3 shoes? Right. It's horrific, horrific fucking scene. Despite everybody's best efforts, all the outrage and the press on the murders only forces the killer underground until he feels safe enough to do it again. The following year, in August of 1967, 7-year-old Christine Darby is playing with friends in her small village of Caldmore, a suburb in Walsall where a desperately sought-after child killer had last struck. It is around 2:30 p.m. when a car pulls up to a small group of children and a handsome man with brown eyes asks for directions to a local area known as Caldmore Green. Christine, 7 years old, she knows where the man wants to go. It's just down the street. And she's excited to jump into the car to show him when he asks her if she will. And this is too easy. The 7-year-old has rarely been in a vehicle as her mom doesn't own one. And sitting up front on these newspapers, which is kind of weird, is an especially delightful treat for the little girl. Her friends watch as the car turns around back to the direction of the A34 road where it had infiltrated from. The kids are well aware of the story of the babes in the ditch. They know about the man in the car who took the girls, and they immediately realize once the car turns away from where Christine had pointed for the man to go, that she's been abducted. They run, shouting through the village to anyone who will listen, that Christine Darby had just been kidnapped. By the time Christina's mother gets to a payphone and police scramble to create roadblocks, it's been far too long. There is no time in such situations. Just moments. In a village where the missing posters of Diana Tift and Margaret Reynolds still skip across the streets when the wind picks up, another little girl will now have her frozen image stapled to lampposts and community boards. A bright little boy who'd heard the man speaking to Christine recalled that the man had pronounced Culmore Green as Carmer Green, which wasn't typical of an out-of-towner. That was the local dialect, the way to say it, and I probably fucked it up, but he said it the way that locals would say it. And this was a good tip, the first that nearly confirmed the child killer had to be amongst them. Another witness claims to have seen a brown-haired girl in the front seat of a gray vehicle, speeding in the direction of Cannock Chase, the wood. The driver had been white, with brown hair, and he was clean-shaven. Approximately 500 police officers and 250 soldiers from the local army regiment began a search of the woods known as Cannock Chase, only a mile from where the so-called Babes in the Ditch had been discovered a year and a half previous. A soldier will find Christine Darby. She is covered by broken fern branches and lays within a cluster of trees. The 7-year-old is found lying on her back, naked from the waist down. It is clear she'd been raped, then strangled in this spot. Her tongue and eyes protrude. And I take no pleasure in sharing these details, as I'm sure you take none listening to them. But the fact that this little girl was left as she was leaves me with the sense that her killer had treated her as a quick snack. Do you know what I mean? The others, he had taken them, brought them out, dumped them. This one he quickly brings in, knows he's going to be tracked down quickly, gets her into the woods as quickly as he can, rapes her and leaves, strangles her and leaves her right there. It's like it had just happened to her the way she was laid out, and I've given enough detail on that, but I could give you more, but I don't want to. It's like he did it, and he just got up and left and threw some branches over and all one-stop shop for... Well, if it was a one-stop shop, he would have done it on the street, but I think you know what I'm getting at. You know, he knew he didn't have a lot of time. And there are tire tracks nearby that tell his story. The killer had brought the girl out here, committed this evil act, then reversed his vehicle quite some distance, I think about 150 yards, back down a narrow trail without any hesitation. He is an expert driver, and he moves with purpose through the act. He's not diddle-dallying. He's a pro. Many of us would slowly back a vehicle down a forest-shrouded lane, especially after raping and strangling a little girl. And we might shift left to right slightly as we went, you know, even without a bunch of pressure on us. You might, you know, kind of adjust because you're thinking too much. You might hit trees beside you and all that. We'd have to stop and adjust along the way. But this killer, this monster of the chase, had treated a desolate dirt back road, rarely used by even park officials, like it were his personal driveway. The tire tracks on the way in are nearly perfectly covered by the ones reversing out, reminiscent of the way that he laid the one little girl on top of the other, Diana and Margaret, in the Babes in the Ditch case, which is about a mile and a half away from this crime scene. The girl was likely dead before the first detail of her abduction had been shared with investigators. Investigators who now had 3 unsolved homicides of little kids on their hands. Little girls, stolen from within a 17-mile radius of each other, and each hustled away on the A34 to die brutally under the forest cover of the chase. 2 witnesses come forward after large posters have been stapled to the trees of Cannock Chase with an image of Christine Darby in a white shirt with little hands clasped over the black pants that would be found in a heap near her body. The posters would feature the name Christine in bold block letters, and set in capitals on them, these posters, quote, "Did you see her here on Saturday, August 19th? If so, tell the police," end quote. What a place to hike. Can you imagine hiking in such a place after something like this had happened, walking past those signs? A little girl died here, and they found two other ones, not but a mile and a half away from her, dumped on, you know, dumped over there. You know, the babes in the ditch? Yeah, this is what Canic Chase features these days. Have a nice walk. Don't pick too many flowers. You know, those are for sightseers. Two witnesses come forward and share that they had seen a suspicious man in a suspicious vehicle in Canic Chase the afternoon of Christine Darby's abduction, rape, and murder. The witnesses, a man named Victor Whitehouse and a woman named Jeanne Rawlings, helped to develop a composite sketch of a clean-shaven, handsome man with dark hair. They also give a solid description of the vehicle. Jeanne is near certain that the make of the vehicle was an Austin Cambridge A60, which leads an army of investigators to follow up and interview tens of thousands of people with this make of vehicle in England. Word from a lead investigator here at the time, quote, "We are convinced that the man who murdered Christine Darby is the man in the identikit picture, and that this is a good likeness. His is a face well known to someone, probably to several people. He is being shielded, either by a relative who knows of his guilt but is prevented from coming forward by misguided loyalty or fear, or by people who recognize a resemblance in an acquaintance but cannot bring themselves to believe that the person could be a child killer. The innocent, and many innocent men that may resemble the picture, have nothing to fear. But no child is safe while the man guilty of the murder of Christine Darby walks free." End quote. The sketch of the suspect creates an avalanche of tips, many from armchair Agatha Christie's mucking up the investigation. One from the killer's brother is initially lost in the pile of leads, as the man in question was alibied by his young wife. And this killer, we're going to finally catch up to right now. Mood, everybody. Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends. They'll deliver them discreetly right to your doorstep. And you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code Dark Topic. I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself, and it's wild how different each one feels. Their sleepy time gummies knock me out in about 15 minutes flat. Actually, like 10 minutes, more like 5. I mean, I'm a pretty sleepy guy when it's time for sleepy time. But in the morning, what I appreciate about them is that there's no hangovers, no grogginess. I wake up feeling just fine. And their epic euphoria gummies, they're perfect for those days when nothing's going right and you just need to hit the reset button on your crappy mood. What makes these different is how they've paired THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're just not going to find gummies like this in a dispensary or anywhere for that matter. And they have gummies for literally everything. Immune support, menopause relief, PMS symptoms, mental clarity, sexual arousal. And each one is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on small family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no BS, and they can ship to most states in the U.S. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfactory guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code Dark Topic. So head to mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code Dark Topic at checkout to save 20% off on your first order. Did you know your calendar age doesn't always match how old your body truly is? It's true. Your biological age, the age of your cells and organs, is actually the number one predictor of your risk for serious diseases like heart disease, cancer, dementia, and more. This means knowing your biological age can quite literally change your life. That's where the True Age Test from True Diagnostic comes in. With the True Age Test, you can uncover your true biological age and get personalized insights into your risk for chronic conditions like Alzheimer's and even early mortality. And it's all done from the comfort of your own home. No doctor visits, no lab appointments, just a simple kit delivered right to your door. I've been looking for something like this, and it's found me. I recently ordered the test myself so I could better understand my long-term health, and oh boy. And the reason why I did it was because The research shows that if your biological age is just 5 years older than your chronological age, your risk of developing major diseases can rise by 30 to 50%, and that's a huge wake-up call for me. But here's the good news. Up to 90% of biological aging is influenced by lifestyle. That means your daily habits, environment, and choices play a major role, and that gives you real power to slow down aging and reduce your health risks. I'm excited to get my results. I'm assuming they're not that great, but what I'm trying to do is cheat the test. I'm just getting healthy before I took the test, you know? A couple of weeks sober, a couple of weeks not smoking cigarettes and all that. I'm hoping that I can ace this thing, but I'm not optimistic. The test itself is super easy and convenient. You can do it from home. Just a quick, painless finger prick. You then send off that tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. Fast and hassle-free. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code DARKTOPIC to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use DARKTOPIC at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. November the 4th, 1968. After 15 months of hibernation, the Cannock Chase Monster emerges once again from the A34 and drives slowly through Walsall, hunting for yet another little girl. He spots one on Bridgman Street, 10-year-old Margaret Alton, standing on a patch of waste ground, throwing hunks of wood onto a growing bonfire by herself. And excuse me, pardon me, what? Can you believe this? In an area where little girls are known to get snatched from, a little girl is outside in a desolate street corner by herself having a bonfire? Tending to a hobo's, I don't know, furnace? If I'm the monster of the chase and I pull up to this scene, I'm gone. Surely this is a baited trap, but no, this is just small town England circa 1968, where apparently they feed kids to sex predators like mice to a pet python, or, you know, that goat in Jurassic Park that goes up to feed the T-Rex? What is going on here? The green Ford Corsair with a cream-colored roof is what the killer is driving now. He's gotten rid of the other cars as they've been spotted. It's necessary to swap out each after each hunt. He's yet to pull off an abduction without the car being spotted, but it's a small price to pay for such forbidden delicacy. He pulls to a stop and the girl turns around. She's backlit by the flames of the bonfire, as if the devil himself has plated her for this killer. "Would you like some fireworks, little girl? I have rockets and Catherine wheels." Margaret excitedly runs over, but because she's apparently some kind of street urchin, her childish wonder is reined in by a healthy tug of suspicion. The 10-year-old looks past the handsome man with the soft brown eyes and observes the front passenger seat is covered with newspapers. Her eyes dart to the back seat where she sees no fireworks. When she looks back to the man as she comes to a stop on the sidewalk, his soft brown eyes are now hard black stones, and he is swiftly exiting the car. Margaret turns to run, but he is on her, grabbing an arm to drag the now screaming girl into the idling Corsair. That's when a young woman shouts out from the front of a fish and chip shop down the street. 18-year-old Wendy Lane had watched the whole incident from a window while waiting for food. Wendy ruins this chance for the monster's own order of takeaway. He releases the girl and jumps into his vehicle, speeding away past the chip shop with his head down and turned. But in another act of sharp thinking, Wendy Lane looks not at the man, but at his license plate. She calls it into police, more well aware of what's going on than this girl's parents, apparently. Wendy remembers the plate as 429-LOP. She also shares the make and model, that being a Ford Corsair. And this tip is massive, but initially it yields no result. The investigation is dogged, however. There's untold number of hours put into this case, untold amounts of people that have been sifting through interviews by police that have gone door-to-door talking to thousands of people, men who age between 21 and 50, fitting the description, vehicles that match the previous two vehicles, That one being a gray vehicle, and the other being a two-tone one with a police light on the front. This is a massive investigation. I shouldn't in any way downplay it. The police are doing the best they can in this time. And the number that Wendy Lane gives to police doesn't initially match any green and cream colored Ford Corsair. But they switch around the numbers. They decide that maybe she got the numbers wrong or the letters wrong. And it turns out that there is a license plate attributed to a green and cream Ford Corsair with the plate number 492LOP, as opposed to the 429LOP that she thought she'd seen. And this is registered to a one-time suspect in this case. You know, it yields a hit. The suspect had been previously looked at amongst thousands of other men matching the sketch, but had been alibied by his young wife. 39-year-old Raymond Leslie Morris, a foreman at an engineering works, lives with his second wife, Carol, in an apartment directly across the street from the Walsall Police Department. Raymond Morris is handsome with dark hair, brown eyes, and a clean shave, which isn't unusual. You know, there's a lot of Englishmen with dark hair, brown eyes, and a clean shave. He'd been interviewed, though, four times as a potential suspect, but overlooked each time as his abused young wife had claimed to be with Morris during the time of each abduction. Morris's first wife, whom he'd had two boys with, would share that Raymond was very abusive and controlling. She felt it was quite likely that he had manipulated his new wife, Carol, whom was 14 years his junior, into lying for him. Of further interest, Raymond Morris had owned a gray vehicle, an Austin A55, at the time Christine Darby had been stolen away in a gray vehicle. Also, he'd owned a two-tone Vauxhall Velox. I'm sorry, I'm fucking that name up, but it's similar to a Ford Zephyr, as I recall, in America. And this type of vehicle was recalled by the first botched kidnapping, rape, and murder of 9-year-old Julia Taylor. It was recalled by Julia herself. He'd sold this vehicle after the Babes in the Ditch murders hit the press, which he likely used that vehicle for. And everything was adding up, except his wife, Carol, sticking to her stories, and the unfortunate moment when Wendy Lane, the girl from in front of the chip shop who'd seen the most recent abduction attempt, can't identify Raymond Morris in a lineup because she had been looking at his plates rather than his turned head. The killer is released, but investigators keep a close eye on him while they continue to dig into his history. They're convinced it's him. Soon they gain access to Morris's time cards from the factory. They discover the likely killer had clocked in at 1:13 p.m. on August 19th of 1967. This is significant as Christine Darby had been abducted at 2:30 p.m. the same day. Another arrest warrant is issued after the lead investigator tells a judge, quote, "I think we found the bastard." Raymond Morris is arrested and his apartment, that is right across the street from the police station, is searched. His young wife Carol is brought in for questioning as well. But Carol won't crack. That is until the search of Morris's belongings yields pornographic images of Carol's 5-year-old niece, with her husband's hands molesting the child, a distinctive silver wristwatch that had been noticed by children in previous abductions and attempts, was on the molester's wrist, confirming for Carol it's her husband. It helps her to identify the situation because there are objects in the background that belong to her as the photos were taken in their own apartment. And Carol is sick over this. Another damning piece of evidence emerges when Raymond Morris is being strip searched after his arrest, and they find the silver wristwatch around his ankle. Things move fast. On the 17th of November, just 13 days beyond his final failed abduction attempt, Raymond Leslie Morris is charged with the murder of Christine Darby. In December, he's hit with further charges regarding the molestation of his niece and the attempted kidnapping of Margaret Alton, the fortunate girl, by the bonfire. Carol Morris, his wife, will testify in court that she had lied for her husband each time that he'd been a suspect. She couldn't bring herself to believe he'd be capable of such atrocities, but he had in fact been absent from their flat each time a girl disappeared. She recalls that he'd returned in the early evening after the brazen abduction and raced to the chase, where a killer had quickly dispatched of Christine Darby. Carol remembers that the ending credits of Coronation Street had been on the television when he returned home that day, giving a near exact timeline for his absence on August the 19th, between Morris's clockout, his early clockout from the factory, and his later return home. There is a perfect match for what the killer's window of time to abduct, escape, rape, and kill 7-year-old Christine would have been. Despite Morris likely being responsible for multiple abductions and murders, including, of course, the infamous Babes in the Ditch of Cannock Chase, the prosecution decides that their best shot at putting Raymond Morris away would be to focus on the Christine Darby murder and the most recent attempt at kidnapping of Margaret Alton. This turns out to be an okay course of action. It will take jurors only 2 hours to decide the monster of the chase's fate, following a damaging trial that features mountains of evidence we've sifted through in story form here. The verdict is read by the judge in front of a crowd of angry victim family members. One, a little girl who'd allegedly been molested by Morris, she shouts out that, "That's him," before being removed. Some think that investigators had asked the little girl to say that when it was going on. Remember, there's not just girls who had been abducted and got away, or abducted and murdered in this case. There are girls who had been abducted, molested, digitally penetrated, and let go in the warm-up crimes leading to this. And this is one of those little girls that shouts out, "That's him." This riles up the audience in the court, and the judge moves forward quickly, sensing the possibility of a riot and a lynching of Morris. He addresses the defendant as soon as he gets the ruling from the jury. Quote, "I do not intend to keep you long or make any comment about this terrible murder. There is only one sentence, as you know. Life imprisonment." End quote. Raymond Morris turns and looks coldly at his young wife. Then the bubbling crowd boils over with demands and shouts and yells and oaths. They want this monster to be hanged. The child killer is escorted quickly from the room and is destined to spend the rest of his life in prison. The vehicle Morris had used to kidnap Christine Darby is purchased by a local auto dealer and torched publicly. Raymond Morris will never admit any guilt or show any remorse. He will burn taxpayer money over the next 45 years, finally dying in March of 2014 from natural causes, at the age of 84, burning up a little more cash with his cremation. Before his death, Raymond Morris was considered one of the oldest and longest held prisoners in England's history. It is said that sightings of the black-eyed girls of Cannock Chase increased following the death of Raymond Morris. Myself, you know, I'm a little fucking out there and woo-woo with, you know, I believe in the paranormal and all that, but for this, I don't want to get into it. I think we need to focus on what actually fucking happened here. And I refuse to think that the spirits of murdered girls are trapped in the woods, like most people say. But I don't mind believing that demons, guised as black-eyed children, were riled up by the entry to hell of the monster of the chase. And that'll do it for that one. Yeah, if you want to look more into Cannock Chase, I know there's some people from England who listen. Every time I do a case on anywhere in England, I get a lot of feedback from you guys. So if you have anything to add in the comments about this, or links to articles about, you know, the paranormal on this, anything I found in that respect seems super cheesy and corny. But they do say there's a lot of UFO sightings. There was this drone footage that I saw where they saw a girl in white with black eyes, and it looked like total fucking like an act. There's been photos, though, of women. There was a woman who was going through the woods with her kids. She took a photo of them by a tree, and there was a ghostly shape of a girl who looked like she had black eyes in the photo, which I thought was fairly interesting. But any of the paranormal investigations I saw in it just seemed like a bunch of dickheads running around the woods trying to make themselves scared. And I am a sucker for that stuff, and even I wasn't buying anything enough to be able to try to, resell it to you. So I want to leave it at that. I mean, the truth is fucking scarier than the fiction that people are possibly trying to drum up about that place. Though I will say, I mean, man, from the videos that I've seen, Cannock Chase is a very creepy place with a long history. And I always catch myself on that. Any wooded area, any place on Earth has about a 4.5 billion year history, doesn't it? But England has, you know, a people history. Where I live, there's not a lot of like ancient history because, you know, not a lot of people have lived out here historically, except for maybe some, you know, Native Americans in the past or Vikings or something at some point. But in England, there is a long, long history. And I think that there was a prisoner of war camp in World War I with German soldiers there, where they say that they see a soldier coming through at times. And there was a prison escape there at one point. They talk about werewolves. They talk about these dogs. The people walking through those woods claim to feel like someone's running up on them at times, which freaks me out a little bit. But anyways, the story itself, I feel, was scary enough. Thank you for all your support, as per usual, and I'll be right back with more. I hope you're all well. I'm doing well. I sounded a little fucked up. I think the last few times that I've spoken on That Will Do It, sir, or whatever. I'm doing great. I just needed to calm down a little bit, and I have. And a lot of you reached out, and I read your messages and responded to some. And I really appreciate it. I just try to be honest in the moment a lot of times on this, and then I'll listen back and be like, fuck, man, maybe you shouldn't just ramble on when you're having a moment, you know? My life's great. I got nothing to complain about. And I'm just very happy doing what I'm doing, even though I got to talk about and think about things like this for days and days. I find it very... It's scary, and it's nasty, and it's very disturbing, but I guess I got to say that I find it kind of calming at times to go through an entire different time and situation. And the worst, you know, kids getting kidnapped is a horrible thing, but it brings me a strange kind of calm, feeling like, I just appreciate my kids and that they're okay so much more, and I want to watch over them more. And it humbles me. Because to know what those parents had to go through, and you never heard their stories, as bad as things might seem for any of us, especially me, who's very blessed, God, I just got to be so thankful that at the moment my kids are safe and I don't have to experience anything like that. It humbles me is what I'm trying to say. I'm sorry it happened to them, obviously. I wish it never did. My God, I was talking to my girl about it. I'm like, you know, it makes you feel like these things can still happen. But then you hear a story about like the girl by the bonfire on a piece of wasteland in an area where girls have been stolen from. Like, what the fuck is she doing out there by herself? You know, would that happen today? Maybe. Maybe in some poor neighborhoods it would. Maybe it would. It bothered me that he was able to steal Christine Darby after the Babes in the Ditch happened. With Margaret and Diana, a young Diana and young Margaret, that he was able to get her, take her away. The call came in and they had a plan in place, and still he was able to drive out into those woods only 1.5 miles away from the previous killings and at his luxury really rape and strangle that girl before backing out. 7-year-old Christine Darby was her name. God, 5, 6, 7-year-olds, 10-year-old, I think, in the beginning. I just all to pick up my kids from kindergarten, you know, my kid from kindergarten. And after doing this and seeing little girls and they're bouncing, you know, happy faces. Oh, fuck. Holy fuck. A true monster. Anyways, fuck. Ice Cut Doors Deluxe Day Parent, thank you so much. I'll talk at you real soon.